Good morning, all those in Zoom land. It's also a pure land. I'm sure it's pure. Anybody have stocks in Zoom? Should, really. Very good. So these four thoughts that turn the mind from samsara are considered, they're powerful antidotes to remove a clinging and attachment. And they are common through all the schools of Buddhism, not just Tibetan Buddhism. But one point here that people occasionally ask me about, which we should just mention here, the line that says, since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, it actually means no permanent happiness. That's just taken for granted. It doesn't mean relative happiness. Sure, one's going to find relative happiness. It means no continuum of freedom leading to great bliss wherever there is samsara. So these are called the four common meditations.
Also, it is not certain when the hateful enemy and his present precious body, the power of death, will arrive. I and other beings are impermanent, the time of death being uncertain. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, we will enter the path of nirvana. In order for this body with leisure and wealth to possess meaning, we will abandon the three non-virtuous poisonous afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, and protect the vows and commitments of the three doors.
Refuge to the Dhamma, all its masters of activity.
From now on.
until the attainment of our past awakening. I shall accept your being in space, go for refuge to the true source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the eldest doors of the city. We go for refuge to the keenies, balance all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sangha, Dharma, peaceful, free from attachment. We go for refuge to Sangha, the spreading of human accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharma, also the master's activity.
Refuge dissolves. Separately into one side. Generating bodhicitta.
Of samsara, be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. Regenerate the supreme mind impartial towards all, in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddha in this necessary lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path of the luminous and clear Vajra essence.
Sashi Pochu. in the scented water, arranged with flowers, adorned with simmer and four continents, as well as the sun. By offering the visualized in the field, and my bringing beings to birth in a pure Buddha field. Om Guru Devadakini Radhamandala Pratichaswa.
For those in the room, I think of which there are four or three who've never received generation and completion stage practices or empowerments and that sort of thing, if you wish to practice the hollow body in the form of Idam, you've been receiving permission or that authorization in the recitation of Vajrasattva. So I will read the beginning of the text, which is in your book, prayer book on page 5, which is directly from the Yangtze Gompa liberating instructions, with nothing left out. So this is the short Vajrasattva practice. And Vajrasattva has the two symbols of Vajrayana, or of secret mantrayana, the Dorje, which represents skill and means and great compassion, in the right hand, and is held like this to the heart. And the bell is held like this, and it's held to the hip down here. So when even though the text isn't very clear, the instructions, the oral instructions, because it's Dzogchen, it's great perfection, you arise spontaneously without any effort as Vajrasattva. So the text says, from within emptiness arises Vajrasattva in Sambhogakaya form, holding a Vajran bell. He is seated upon a lotus Samundas throne. In his heart is one's own awareness in the form of Padmasambhava Vajradhara, which is on the front cover of the prayer book. In whose heart, inside Guru Rinpoche's heart, on a moon disk, is a seed syllable hung with the mantra. By reciting the mantra, one's body is filled and washed with nectar. Radiating light causes appearance and existence to appear as Vajrasattva, as the mantra recitation purifies the obscurations of all sentient beings. So my recommendation would be, if you want to practice with what's called a Yidam body, or a enlightened form body of radiance, Vajrasattva would be a great place to start. It's a great place for anybody to start. It's a great place for anybody to continue with, and as a matter of fact, great enlightened beings have finished their work, so to speak, in doing retreats of Vajrasattva. So it's a beginning practice, a middle practice, and very high practice. So there's a recommendation, if you wish to. Okay? If you wish to, then just spontaneously arise in this radiant, clear white, like a white moonstone, which is kind of got a bluey tinge to it, at least the Sri Lankan ones do. Now most of the ones we see are the rainbow ones from India. So rainbow moonstone, white moonstone, but but clear white, radiating light everywhere inside the body, hollow, transparent, cloaked in silks, rainbow garments, and of course the two symbols of the practice of the secret mantrayana, the vajra, which also represents the five primordial wisdoms. And inside here is the bindu of innate awareness placed at the heart, the bell, which is wisdom, placed down here. Of course, they're like this, actually. So they come into union, and Vajrasattva is radiating luminous liberation for all sentient beings. And you see every single sentient being with you. You try to see as many sentient beings as possible turning into Vajrasattva, into a field of enlightened activity. There we go. Okay? So. Can't think of a better place to start. Okay, that's it for this morning. So, to the text of the commentary on Bodhicitta by Nargarjuna. So before I begin, just a few minor thoughts to understand the Dharma, understand the way in which Dharma is taught. I'm going to repeat myself a little bit, but a little bit in a different way than yesterday. When we come to the teaching, when most of us come to the teaching, 99% or so, we are having difficulties with our self-image. We're having difficulties with our self-referencing. We all have addictions of some type, major to minor. We're struggling with our identity, we're struggling with our relationships, we're just struggling with who we are in the world, what we're going to become, and so on. A lot of self-referencing. And of course, it's quite natural, and it's quite absolutely understandable that with all the turmoil and anxiety, which is also another word for dukkha, with all the stress and the conflict going on inside, outside, that the most natural thing to do would be to shut the mind up. Does that make sense? Just be quiet. It makes perfect sense. So that is also why so many beings are meditating today. You'll see in the first turning of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths, that the heart of the causal, the cause of dukkha, the one thing that we need to go for is the attachments and the clingings to soften and then vanquish the clingings. All right? Otherwise, life is just too rough. It's not just about tranquility, it's about insight too. It's about freedom. It's just too hard going if one is grasping at everything like a drowning being, on the ocean, and someone throws in a life raft, and you can't quite get the life raft. But if you've ever, anybody ever taken life, life-saving courses, yes? Bronze Cross and so on? Ever take those? What's one of the things they teach you? Breaks, hold, and releases, right? Ever get those? Breaks, hold, and releases. Drowning beings will kill you if you try to save them. If you come up to them without the right means, the right understanding, a drowning being can actually hold you and pull you under. It's happened. So in these advanced life-saving courses, they teach you break, holds, and releases, how to get out of it. So from the point of view of the struggle, of the friction, of the disease, it makes perfect sense to go after the things that you feel you are attached to, soften and release them. Absolutely perfect, lovely. But from the standpoint of the second and the third turning of the Buddha's teaching, the cause, really, the reason we attach and we cling is because of not understanding the nature of concepts. That's all. We grasp onto concepts. We grasp onto concepts, experiences, as real things, when in fact they're illusory. And we'll get deeper and deeper and deeper. This is Mahamudra, Dzogchen. So the clinging in the beginning feels like things. Does it make sense? Things, ideas, emotions, they're things. And the Buddha taught this way in the beginning. These are the part of the 202 dharmas many of them, beings want to grasp to them, like a drowning being in water. But when we mature, if you wish, and we soften the clinging, we soften the attachment, we can see that, in fact, the Buddha introduced the practice that, in fact, the concepts and the experiences are empty in nature, and you can't actually cling to them. It's a very different point of view, and it's a very mature point of view. So for many people, it's a really good idea to get out of the mass of clinging objects and reduce the amount of friction caused by being surrounded by things that one is attached to. Does it make perfect sense? And that's quite natural in the spiritual life. Get rid of all the clutter. Empty your house out. Don't have men and women ever meditating together. For sure, don't do that. As the Tibetans say, for sure babies are sure to arise. Yeah? So you have monasteries. The food becomes very simple. You take away the caviar, you take away the fine cheeses, you take away the good coffee, you just give them really bad coffee and really low-level tea. It's also cheaper. Yeah, and then, of course, you don't buy expensive shoes, you buy shoes that really kind of, you know, simple shoes, like Birkenstocks. Just kidding. Everybody, some people know the hidden joke there. Anyways, they're very expensive. Right? So, and you make simple cabins, and you simplify your life so you're not attached to this and this and this and this and this. But eventually you realize that even that doesn't liberate. It helps. It's a great aid. It's a great antidote. But eventually you're going to have to look at your mind, because everything is happening in your mind. Right? The food is not out there. Where's the food? In your mind. Can't be out there. The experience is where? In your mind. Where's all the attachment? In your mind. Where's the clinging? In your mind. So eventually, you have to look at your mind's nature. Okay. So Nargarjuna is slowly, piece by piece, using logic and meditational skill and means to bring us to look at our mind's nature. But first of all, we have to dismantle the crazy logic, the crazy ideas about experience that we're holding, including ancient Buddhists and including great philosophers. So as a master of the intellect and as a master of meditation, he was a great yogi, considered one of the great, 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 great yogis and enlightened beings of India. He is slowly demolishing everything that one could ever possibly hold on to. Extraordinary teaching. So now we'll go to number 8. He's also, through 112 verses, clarifying the scope of emptiness and compassion, bit by bit by bit. You have to let it sink in. Okay, so to number 9. And this is literally pretty much step by step exact removal of the concepts that are in the way. Now, he's not going to deal with the 84,000 afflictive states. So when you start to practice Dharma, we don't entertain the complexities of emotion. We go after the core emotions, which are greed, hatred, delusion, and a few others. Actually, what's called the 52 volitional states. Okay? Because they're the ones that actually need to be purified. It can get too complex dealing. So this is one of the, sometimes the criticism you hear every once in a while. Buddhists, they don't like emotions. No, it's not that they don't like emotions. It's just emotions are highly complex phenomena that don't easily lead to insight realization. Make sense? And then the stories of where the emotions came from simply don't liberate. However, the beautiful thing about modern psychotherapy and the utility of modern psychotherapy is it can often give a much better story to a person than the very damaging story that they're carrying around. If you look at the early writings of Freud and some of his followers, that's really what they were trying to do. They weren't, as I said very clearly, we're not talking about freedom here. We're talking about misery going to less misery. People that can't function, which is one of the definitions of a real neurotic. A real neurotic can't function well. They can't go to work. They can't survive a workplace environment. They can't function in a relationship. They may not be able to handle a Christmas party with family. Do you know what I mean? They may not be able to eat comfortably. They may not be able to go for a walk comfortably. All kinds of things. So socially, economically, the life is misery. And for the people around them, life is a misery. Yeah? But here when we come to Dharma, we can't deal with that level. It's not about that. It's about going right to the very roots of what causes the dukkha and how to come into this freedom. So for someone that's struggling with their self-identity, with their story, with what's going on within them, introducing this vast, beautiful, pristine teaching of Buddha nature, intrinsic wisdom and compassion, bodhicitta, is not really the best thing, necessarily. It can be really disconcerting. Okay? So you have to, the beautiful thing about Dharma is there's 84,000 afflictions, but there's also 84,000 different teachings appropriate to different beings at different times. This is really understood. And Nargarjuna is pretty much going through many of those, the evolution of them. So when you need antidotes, you use antidotes. When you need relative teachings to clear up the difficulties you're in, you use those. When you're relatively free of those, you use other teachings and other skill and means. Make sense? And you have to know that the Dharma contains all of that. But we keep remembering the number one thing about Dharma is the end of story making, the end of projections. Because that's from the point of view of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, that's the key point. The stories, the projections, the imaginations, the constructions must fall. And we believe, most people believe, that the constructions and the stories are going to get us out of it. Not so. No matter how many stories you make, it's not going to work. But it might be helpful in a relative way. Does that make sense? But not freedom. All right. Back to number 9. Number 9, page 2. If it were an entity, it would not be permanent. For entities are always momentary. And with respect to impermanent entities, agency has not been negated. Now that's a pretty mysterious verse. You have to insert where it says it, he, she, or God. It means God, because we're now dealing, 4 to 9 has to do with the positions of the Tirthikas, the Indian philosophers that held, some of them who held that there is a creator God. If it were an entity, God would not be permanent. So if you say that God is an entity of some type, then God can never be permanent. It's momentary. God comes and goes, comes and goes, and comes and goes. For entities are always momentary. Now, you may not believe that, but you actually have to go somewhere and keep playing with that idea and looking at things until you really get it, that no thing can be permanent. Earth isn't permanent. Universe isn't permanent. The sun's not permanent. As a matter of fact, we're going into a major change this year. It looks like we're going into a really quiet time of the sun. This Vajra, which represents indestructible reality, is not permanent. This brass will dissolve. Even plastics, some plastics can last for 200,000 years in landfills. Even 200,000 years is impermanent. It's all momentary. How do we know it's momentary? You have to look really closely. Does this ceiling look like it's pretty solid and permanent? Yes. If you take a microscope, you'll see that the entire ceiling, all the paint, is flaking off in momentary bits. It's raining down on our heads. It's a dust field. If you have a house, you should know that. The moment you build a house or do a renovation, it's all falling apart. So it's raining momentary pieces of dust. You have to look at it at a wheel. A wheel going around on a car or a bicycle feels like it's going around in a continuous circle. If you look very closely, you'll see it's momentary stages. Gears moving. Everything can be divided into moments. Okay? Very much the heart of Theravadin tradition of insight meditation. Look at the moments, finer and finer and finer moments of clear seeing. And with respect to impermanent entities, any entity is impermanent. The God, the agent, the agency which of creation has not been yet negated. It hasn't fully been negated yet. Now, number 10. This number 10 is quite extraordinary. Okay? When we get to number 10, we're now coming into the Shravaka teaching of the Buddha. This is the first turning of the wheel. And he's going to build it up and then demolish it. Not because it's wrong, but because it's provisional and not full view. Number 10. This world, devoid of self and so on, is utterly vanquished by the notions of aggregates, elements, and the sense fields, and that of object and subject. Okay. We need to insert, to understand that, we need to make sure that we put in, because remember, this is pith instruction, this is pith teaching, which means that if you understand it and you're trained in this, you understand the meanings by implication. By implication, this world is this experiential world. There is no world. No one has a world. We only have an experiential world. You always have to put that in. It's understood in Dharma that this world of ours is experienced by our minds. Yeah. So, and the word devoid there, you could put free. So he's saying something that is momentously liberating. The experience of self and everything else, which is experience, is utterly vanquished. That means the clinging to self and so on, the suffering that is due to clinging and attachment, is utterly vanquished by the notions, by the concepts. And remember, he's putting in the word concept. Before, aggregates, elements, and sense fields were real entities. Now he's slipped in the word notion. They're just concepts. By the concepts of the five aggregates, form, feeling, perception, volitional states, and consciousness, the elements, which are earth, water, fire, and air, which is form, and the sense fields, which are our six bases of sensory experience. All these, which are major meditations, maybe, Shalan, if you could reach there and pull out right below you the Visuddhimagga and the Vimuttimagga. Yeah, you can see them. There's the Vimuttimagga. You have your hands right on the Vimuttimagga. Yep. And then I think that black text, if you go over, is a Visuddhimagga. Okay. Thank you. Do you have any cooties? No. Okay. All right. If you look at all those texts of suttas and Abhidhamma texts of the Buddha, all those meditations are condensed into these two famous texts of the Theravadan tradition. The first one, 1800 years ago, was the Visuddhimagga, all the oral tradition of conduct, of way of life, of virtue, meditations, and wisdom insight practices contained in here. It's thinner. It's way more pithy. All right? 1800 years ago. About 500, 600, no, even more than that. Almost 1,000 years later, Buddhaghosa in Sri Lanka wrote a expanded version called the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification. These contain all the classic practices and meditations that you'll find in Southeast Asia. They also, this one especially, forms the basis of all the Mahayana meditations. You'll find most of the Mahayana meditations in here, in seed form, in pithy form. So when he mentions the aggregates, he means the great insight meditation, Vipassana meditation, on meditating on the five skandhas, the five aggregates. When he mentions the elements, he means one of the most famous Theravadan and Mahayana meditations on the four elements, which later became the five elements, adding space, and the sense fields. And we'll get into more detail about those later. But they're all found, those meditations are perfectly described in utter detail in these two texts. If you go to Southeast Asia, you can go to monasteries that specialize in these. There's monasteries, retreat centers, where different teachers will specialize in these meditations. When we practice meditations like Vajrasattva or Three Roots, there's the mandala of the Dzogchen Three Roots practice, a complete, full exposition of it on that in that painting. When we practice those, we're actually also practicing the meditations on the aggregates, elements, and sense fields, and also that of subject and object of what's called consciousness. These aggregates, elements, and sense fields and a subject-object constitute the major practices of Vipassana. So when we meditate on those, these he's calling them concepts. From the Theravadan point of view of the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, they're not concepts, they're real. Okay, you read the text, they're real. They're real things. Part of the 202 real things of the Abhidhamma. But when it comes to Mahayana, it comes to Vajrayana, they're actually quite amazing concepts, but they're not real things. And that of subject and object. Number 11, thus the Buddhas who seek to help others have taught to the disciples. Now you can put in brackets there, the word disciple is a translation of the word Shravaka. Shravaka are the hearers that would liberate by tradition through hearing the Dharma. They practice meditation, they'd study, they'd listen, and there's been a long tradition of beings who study, practice, and listen, and so on, to awakening during a Dharma discourse. And that is the word Shravaka, the disciples or the hearers of Dharma. From the Mahayana point of view, the great vehicle point of view, the Shravakas, now this is a bit of a nasty turn, I'm not quite keen on it, but, nor was Namgyal Rinpoche, but because but the Shravakas mostly were on about liberation for themselves. So that striving for liberation for oneself is now going to be what's the word? Vanquished. Have taught the disciples the five aggregates: form, feelings, perception, volitional forces, and consciousness. Okay, as entities, as things. As soon as you go into sensation, you vanquish. If you go into sensation deeply enough by momentariness, let me know if you don't understand what I mean. Okay. By the way, you can put your hand up, because the question that you might have may be a question that other people have. Is everybody following me? If you look very closely with a very clear, lucid mind and slow down, and you look at sensation, and I mean feel sensation, what's going to happen to you? You vanish. It's really fast. If you look at feelings, mental feelings, and you go completely into momentariness of mental feeling, at less than 1/10 of a second, what's going to happen to you? Won't be there. You might struggle with that because you want to be there, but eventually it'll dawn on you that when you look very carefully, you're not there. When you look at volitional states, what happens? You vanish. The collection of the concept of you just vanishes. If you look in subject-object long enough, you just look at subject-object making. Gone. You gone. Perception? Just meditate on a sense field, like your eyes, just experiencing. There's no you there. It's really fast. So this notion of the clinging to you, the clinging to a being who is real and solid, vanishes fairly quickly with the practice of momentary, clear seeing and following and being attentive to form, feelings, perception, volitional forces, and consciousness. Okay, let me know if you have any. The heart of Vipassana, yes. A modern Vipassana, yeah.
Could you explain the difference between perception and consciousness?
Yes. Perception is the seeing. But consciousness, in this case, I need to go into that deeper, but consciousness case is I am seeing something. It's a dualistic consciousness. So when this is shown, there's simply an object to the sense field. As soon as consciousness, dualistic consciousness, comes into it, there is a seeing of an object. You know you're seeing an object, and now you're having concepts about the object.
Animals have perception, but not consciousness.
That's right. So when we come to what's called the meditation of the 18 elements, which is one of that's found in both these texts, incredible meditation. It's called an anupassana. It's a ripening vipassana practice. Then one meditates, we're coming to this, one meditates on the object of experience, the sense field, and the consciousness that lights up the experience. If we do that, then we actually knock out the dualistic consciousness. Okay? Beautiful, beautiful practice. When they use the word consciousness here, and they mean it different than perception, they mean perception and sensing without the dualistic mind. Without the dualistic mind, receiving the consciousness, okay? Before you're aware of the object. Great. Number 12. By the way, never put these meditations down. They're incredibly high. And I recommend that everybody, I'll say almost everybody, have a good go at these practices, sometimes before Vajrayana practices, sometimes after, good go of Vajrayana practices, and sometimes in between, back and forth. They're excellent. As Antrim Prishe said to a group of people that have been practicing and studying Dzogchen and Mahamudra for about 13 years somewhere in the world, it's good that you've been practicing this, but you don't really have much of an idea of Dharma. So sometimes in the pursuit of mind, we can miss very easily the basic teachings that are very high. Excuse me. Just spread some love around. Number 12. Okay, now we're going into the completion stage, Vipassana, with completion stage with support. It's called Vipassana or penetrative Vipassana. With support, it's also these meditations, number 12 and 13, are also taught in the Vimuttimagga, the path of liberation, and the Visuddhimagga, these two texts, and the path of purification. So here we go. The excellent among the bipeds. Bipeds is another word, it's a very classic word for humans, those that walk with 2 feet, 2 legs. The excellent, the bodhisattvas, excellent as bodhisattvas or Buddhas, the excellent among the humans, always taught as well, forms appear as mass of foams. Feelings resemble bubbles in water, and perception is like a mirage. So now what he's doing is he's taking the five aggregates and going into the way the Buddha would describe them as a contemplation. It's called a contemplation with support, using examples of illusion, classic examples of illusion, form, that is rupa, body form, as a mass of foams, feelings, that is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, as bubbles, bless you, as bubbles in water. Perception, sanya, is like a mirage. Then let's go down to number 13. Mental formations, volitional states, are like the plantain trees. They're banana trees. Consciousness, subject to object consciousness, vijnana in Pali, Sanskrit. Vijnana in Pali, vijnana in Sanskrit, is like a magical illusion. Those are the five. Presenting the aggregates, that is the five heaps, the skandhas, in this way, the Buddhas taught thus to the bodhisattvas. All bodhisattvas in training, that's us, all of us, have to go and study and practice the five aggregates. It's at the heart of all Vajrayana practice, it's at the heart of all Mahayana practice, and it's the heart of all Hinayana practices. You don't get around it. It's the wisdom mandalas. It's everywhere. It's all through those suttas. It forms the basis of all dharma and meditation, dharma meditation. So, why do I say completion stage or Vipassana with support? Because we're using metaphors and analogies to support our contemplation, whereas a completion stage or Vipassana without support means we're only resting in awareness. Here we're resting in a metaphor. Very quick. There are 12 classic, in Mahayana there's 12 classic illusions or metaphors for illusion. Magical creations, which is here, which is conscious, is like a magical illusion. If you want to write these down, these are very speedy, by the way. These practices will bring you to experiences of empty. It's not necessarily compassion. not for compassion, but for emptiness, really quick. Magical creations. Number two, a mirage. Number three, the city of the Gandharas, the city of the gods. So that's short form for looking up at clouds and seeing these godlike realms appearing in clouds and mistaking the cloud formations as places where there's heavens and gods sport and play. That's the short version of that. Number four, a rainbow. Number five, an image in a mirror. Number six, moon, the moon reflected in water. Number seven, an echo. Number seven, an echo. Number seven, a triple echo. Number eight, a dream. Number nine, optical illusions like cataracts. Any kind of optical illusion. There's many, many examples are given. We have many modern. There's new psychological optical illusions that come out every year or so. They're quite something. People discover these optical illusions. But a cataract is also given, whereas you think the cataract is reality. Look at those. I've seen them. Wow. I can see atoms. You mean the stuff that's the floaters. Oh, okay. So wow. I see all these kinds of like things floating around. That must be meditative experience. No, it's the beginning of cataracts. And then we have number 10, a cloud. Number 11, lightning. And number 12, a bubble on water, a singular bubble on water. And also the foam is used as well. So a bubble or foam is number 12. The plantain tree is also given, which is an alternative in the classic list of 12. Okay, and there's some others, but these are the main ones. It's actually really 13. You'll see all the way through the Theravadan texts and the suttas, the reference to the plantain tree for emptiness.
Why is that? What is it about plantain tree?
Have you all seen banana trees? They're not trees. They're vegetables. They're herbaceous vegetables that peel off. They're not trees at all. So when you see them, they're a tree, but when you go investigate, they just hollow. Let me just peel them, just peel the layers off. They're not a tree. But we think they're a tree, and everybody uses the concept tree, right? Tree, plantain tree, banana tree. But when you go investigate, you see it's nothing of the sort. So this is exactly what it means. You go and investigate, it's nothing of the sort. You're out in the desert, and you see this beautiful city, and you go, oh my God, I'm so thirsty, I can't wait to get to the town. You're in the Sahara, and you go, it's not a town. Ever had that happen in life? You know, maybe if you're your banker or a nice bank ad, if you do this, and you'll be able to retire in, 15 years. If you do this, everything will be fine. If you do this, it'll be all okay. And then you get there and you go, it wasn't quite the way it was stated. Or you write a contract and one party sees the contract a different way, even though it's completely, like, it looks shut and tight, completely understandable to you, right? And the person interprets it completely a different way. Magical illusions everywhere.
So number 14 would be the stock market, for instance.
Number 14, yes, would be the stock. Bubbles flying off all the time. Or rainbows, pots of gold, and then you go to find the pot of gold, and no pot of gold there. People believing, oh, I've got my money in the bank. You don't have any money in your bank, right? It's all being traded in zeros and ones around the planet. You don't have any money. pretty soon, I predict, I don't, I think maybe in 4, 5, 6 years, even currency, paper currency will be completely gone. If as soon as most countries can get rid of paper currency, they will. These are the great, these great metaphors. These metaphors, especially the image in a mirror and the moon reflecting water, are used all the way through the Dzogchen and Mahamudra texts in the sadhanas as what's called completion stage with support. They form the two most direct means of attainment to illusory body, illusory nature of phenomena, meditations with support. How do you practice these? So you have lots to do, but if you want to practice these, I suggest you do, then you can look at a mass of foam. A mass of foam in the morning, you ever seen those bubbles in the morning? What happens an hour later? All gone. They look solid, they look real, they look firm. I like the bathtub meditation. We don't have a lot of bathtubs here. But when you get home, you can fill up your bathtub with bubbles, lie in the bathtub, and you can see how all the bubbles are interconnected. There's not one bubble that is a soul bubble. Just wiggle your toe. It's great meditation. Just wiggle your finger. And what's happening to the bubbles? Forms. How many people have a constant body here? What's it feel like? Same body you woke up in the morning, right? What are those 100 trillion cells doing?
Dying.
Jiggling. Okay. Dying. Moving. And they're moving at incredible speeds. Dividing. Being infected, throwing off infections, the speed by which every cell is vibrating, moving, jelly-like, flowing, is constant. And by the way, if you have a microscope to see, blowing up. Apoptosis, right? The cells just die. They're programmed cell death. Boom, boom, boom. Breaking apart. Ever see a virus come out? That'd be a great movie to show. Virus particles coming out of a cell, bursting out of a cell. Like a mass of foam. Our forms, all forms, are like a mass of foam. Even the wood that we're looking at, a piece of wood, cells breaking apart, collapsing, and so on. Okay. So bubbles in water, same thing. Feelings are just like bubbles in water. Perception like a mirage. So if you use these metaphors, you can come often more quickly to the empty nature of what feels like something solid when in fact it is not. It's an illusion. Mental formations, volitional states are like a plantain tree. Keep peeling them back and you'll keep finding more or less, but they're just like layers. Consciousness, which is subject-object conscious, is like a magical illusion. Subject? Gee, the subject wasn't there. Not quite the way I thought it was. It's like sometimes people with their balance sheets, right, Monique? They go to the treasurer, they go to the accountant and say, but I knew I had more money. No, you don't. Actually, you have more. I like that. Ever go to the bank with some cash and you know, you counted it and you go there and they say, excuse me, but it's this. And you go, it's more. That's good. That's a bonus. But it's pretty often for accountants say, you don't quite have as much money as you thought. So, subject, object. The person that you look at, yes, from a distance, is not the person that you see close up. Is that correct? Have you ever seen those new high definition videos on television? You can see every pore. You can see the cake makeup. It's almost too much. Yeah? So So when we're way, way back, we can make all kinds of fantasies about a person. Yeah? We get close, and we start talking, and we start interacting. Oh my goodness, it's not anything like we thought. Do you see? Nothing at all is like we thought. Not anything. Not in science. One of the wonderful things about science is you'll realize that nothing at all that you investigate is at all like the way you thought. It's a beautiful experience. Not at all. So I'm going to pause there for a moment and see if there's any questions about this. Yes.
So I wanted to put this text in context and also ask a question about Vajrayana as it was practiced and taught at the time in Tibet. Here as we're talking, we have this historical perspective where you can constantly reference Hinayana and Mahayana and Vajrayana and bounce back and forth, and this text is doing that as well.
Although it's mostly moving in order. It's mostly moving Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess my question then is, in Tibet, was Hinayana being referenced as Hinayana, or was it already baked into the Vajrayana teaching?
Is already baked into the Vajrayana teachings. So in Tibet, like in India during the great period of the great Indian monasteries, Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana was all rolled into one. Explained, but also rolled into one. So, these are concepts. If you're a Vajrayana practitioner, you're practicing Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. You never, in a negative way, get rid of Hinayana. You must have Hinayana. So that's why Nam Shrimshi didn't call it lesser teaching. He didn't like that. And either do I. Basic teaching, basis teaching. It's very high teaching, in fact. But it's not, it's provisional. It's still mixed with conceptual notions. And it doesn't necessarily lead to Buddhahood. But, so it all gets rolled into one, so even in a sadhana, there is Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But it's all under the umbrella of Vajrayana, skill means. Okay, that makes sense? Now, some people will say, and some scholars, and some very traditional say, and remember, the Theravadan teaching was basically the school that survived in Southeast Asia out of 18 schools. And there was differences, and some substantial differences. The core teaching of the Buddha never changed, never got modified. But there was some major differences, not around the Four Noble Truths, not around the real core of the teaching, but around some other stuff, okay? And some important stuff, especially around self. The Theravadan school, which is very precious and very valuable, is the main one that survived culturally. But if you go to Burma and Thailand, you're going to find all kinds of other schools going on intermixed within the Theravadan. People, a lot of Westerners don't know that. There's the Mahasiddha tradition, there's all kinds of yogic traditions, there's Dharmakaya tradition, there's the Dharmakaya yogas, there's all kinds of practices and tantric practices taught in Burma, but they're not taught publicly. You'll get booted out of your monastery for those sort of things. But they are taught. All right. So we have to be very careful about these terms and the nature of these terms. Okay? Yes?
So right now you're speaking...
One more point. From my point of view, and a number of others, I don't think it in any way is possible, let me rephrase that, that the Buddha wasn't schooled in Tantra and wasn't schooled in Vajrayana principles, and he was certainly a Mahayanist. He manifested Mahayana principles. So it is said in modern scholasticism in the last 10 years, the Mahayana wasn't really a school. It was more a movement that you found within most Indian monasteries in ancient India and grew eventually into a movement.
Retrospective.
Yeah, but a lot of practitioners were practicing both. Or so it's not like a suddenly there's a Mahayanas there. It's not really like that. Yeah.
So I'm not super familiar with the three turnings of Buddhism. The first one is Theravada.
No. First one is Hinayana. Because within Theravadan, there's all kinds of Mahayanas and Vajrayanas. So we have to be very careful. We never say that Theravada is Hinayana. Theravada is a school, and a very rich school, called the Elders, that's what it means, that developed after the Buddha's death and grew and survived as the major school with the major texts and the major suttas and the Abhidhamma texts in Southeast Asia. Okay? But we can see the traces of other schools of texts that went to Tibet and China and ended up in Japan. So it is clearly known even what the philosophical positions are of the 18 schools, and some of them are even found in the Theravadan Abhidhamma. The actual positions are there, the other schools. Yeah.
So I was just saying, I'm not super familiar with the history. When I hear the three turnings, basically that means that over time the Buddhism evolved to include basically more a non-dualistic view over time.
No, not really. From a scholastic point of view, from Western, not so much anymore, but from Western Buddhist scholars, it was a historical development because that's how they see the texts. From the point of view of Mahayana Vajrayana, it's not particularly historic. It's actually been there from the very beginning. As a matter of fact, I can show you texts that are in the suttas that are definitely Vajrayana texts. It's just not referenced. So really, it's to do with an evolution of what beings can actually handle in terms of discourse. That's how it's phrased. And even today, it's understood in terms of more modern Buddhist classicism as not three turnings historically, three descriptive ways in which liberation occurs. But from the point of view of Vajrayanas, the Mahayana description is provisional. From the view of Vajrayana, the Mahayana is provisional. It's not a full exposition of Buddha nature. Okay? But for someone who's Hinayana, and these are just terms. Someone who's Hinayana, and by the way, you see that in practitioners. So if you want to know why I'm saying this, it's not just because they're concepts. You really see this in practitioners. You really see that Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana are really, truly operating in practitioners. And it can fluctuate within a day, it can fluctuate within years, it can fluctuate. It's really there. It's really, really there. But don't ever say that Hinayana's lowly is just not a full exposition of Buddhahood. It doesn't have the skill and means causally to necessarily bring one to Buddhahood. Okay? But it's so let me be clear. It's also for Chris, a question. For everybody, you have to have a basis in excellent Hinayana development, or you're really in trouble with Mahayana Vajrayana. Okay?
Yeah. So, I'm not super familiar with the main differences. I know we're going through them here, and we've been talking about it over the last couple of days. But I'm not super familiar with the differences between Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana.
Those will all come out, Adam. Just be patient.
Yes.
And all that detail will come out over the days as I teach. And to give you it all at once is too much. And would probably take a week. So it's better to bit by bit keep expounding the differences instead of historic, more of an intellectual course. I'm trying to actually give a flavor for the meditations and a flavor for mental awakening development as opposed to give it to you all at once. You go, okay, I got it now. I promise you, I'm going to say you, but I mean we, are not going to get it today. It's really deep, these differences. Okay? So bit by bit by bit. And maybe I'll write something up. Put it on a piece of paper and then go, this is Hinayana, this I have somewhere in my handouts. This is Hinayana, this is Mahayana, this is Vajrayana. Okay? But I'd rather you hear it first before you just read it, go, okay, got it. A lot of people do that, you know. I read it, therefore I got it. Yeah. Hear the subtle differences. Hear Lama Mark's wanderings through the flavors of these things. Okay. Yeah, I think Jeff had a question.
Yeah, I was just wanted to make sure that my understanding of this text that Arjuna was born in around 200 AD,
mm-hmm.
and so this is coming out of India. It's not out of Tibet. It's much earlier. So
this is an Indian text.
It's all embedded in this teaching.
That's
for
correct.
A really long time.
Yep. This is an Indian text.
Oh.
That's right.
That's helpful, yeah.
this
reference the dates in there anyway.
Yeah. This text is the flowering during the Mahayana period. But it's also known that Nargajuna was also a great Vajrayana practitioner. It starts right out with secret mantrayana. So he's deeply schooled in Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana.
That totally contradicts the idea of it being a historical development.
Totally. Totally. You have to see the development of Dharma as out of place and out of time. And we're actually all like that too. At any given moment, we're sitting here in a Hinayana mode. At any time, we're sitting here in a Vajrayana mode. It's out of time and space.
So this was written before Buddhism came to Tibet.
Yeah, that came in 800 with Guru Rinpoche.
Yeah, about 300-400 years. Yep. Yep. Remember, Buddhism was also coming to Tibet before Guru Rinpoche. So, you know, Buddhism was in Greece. The Greeks were in, you know, 2,000 years ago, the Greeks were in India receiving Buddhist teachings and influencing Buddhist teachings. So we can have history and we can have oral liberative teaching. But both are great. Number 14, how are we doing for time there, folks? One thing to have a watch, but it's another thing to bury the watch. Number 14. Also, let's reference back to the beginning of the text. You'll see here, bowing, number one, bowing to the glorious Vajra holder, to Vajrasattva, who embodies the awakening mind. If you really want an idea, when it says homage to the glorious Vajrasattva at the beginning, if you ever want to know what is the mind and speech and body of Vajrasattva, here it is. You got it. 112 verses describing the nature and skill of Vajrasattva. That's from this being's point of view. I've never heard that expressed, but that's how I see it. Number 14, that which is characterized by the four great elements, what's called in Pali the four great Mahabhutas, the great is Mahabhutas, earth, water, fire, and air, is clearly taught to be the aggregate of form. So the four great elements is one of the greatest insight practices of Southeast Asia and comes also into the Dzogchen and Mahamudra traditions as a great contemplation as well. It's clearly taught to be the aggregate of form, what's called in Pali rupa, R long U-P-A, rupa, which means to break apart. The rest, the other four, vedana, sanya, samskaras, and vijnana, feelings, perception, volitional states, and consciousness, are invariably established, therefore, as devoid of material form. So this is doing is saying that form is the form part of the five aggregates. Actually, we had a whiteboard. There are five aggregates. Only one constitutes matter and form. All the rest are mental entities, all right? Or non-entities. Okay. Number 15. Through this, these five aggregates, through this, the eyes, visible forms, and so forth. Okay, I'll read it first. Which are described as the elements. These should be known also as the 12 sense fields, and as the objects and the subjects as well. Okay. It's one of the great meditations in the Vimutti Magga and Visuddhi Magga, and also in Mahayana and Vajrayana. A little confusing over the word elements there. Here the elements don't mean the four great Mahabhutas. They mean elements as irreducible elements. All right? So here's how it works. How you get 12 is you have six sense fields. The eye receptor is a sense field. The ear, the sensitive material in the ear, is the hearing receptor. The whole body, the skin of the whole body, is the touch receptor. That tongue and some areas around the tongue is the taste receptor. The nose is the receptor, the sensitive part of the nose and hearing receptors receives sensory information that gets translated into nose information. You have that? Everybody have that? Okay. So we have sense fields and we have objects of those sense fields. The mind in Buddhism, mind is a sense field, just like any others. Okay? The cognitive mind, and a good example of that is this. Anybody have the ability to hear that without the bell ringing? Some of you can do that perfectly. See this? Can anybody see that? Could you mistake the mental image for the real thing? Easily. So the mental base is considered in Dharma, in Abhidhamma, and in the Buddhist teachings to be identical, almost identical as any other physical sense field. Okay. Today we call that the brain. The Buddha would not be pinned down to where the cognitive sense field was located. Later Abhidhammists made it about here, in the valve in the heart. They didn't like the fact that there's no location for it. Kind of bugged them. So they made it over here. But the Buddha would never be pinned down when he was asked, where is the mind base, Mano Dhatu, he said. Okay. So how we get 12? Six sense objects, six sense faculties or receptors. These are called elements. Confusingly enough to say now the four, earth, water, fire, and air are elements, but these are also considered elements, called Dhatus. These should be known as the 12 sense fields. They're also translated as sense 12 fields or 12 elements or 12 dhatus. In Pali, or in Sanskrit, the ayatanas. I think some of you studied, those who studied Abhidhamma, you'll know them as the ayatanas. And then you'll say, how about the 18? Yes, there's the 18 as well. How do we get the 18? By the way, these are very fast insight meditations. Is classically given. How do you get the 18? You have an object, you have a field, and you have a consciousness that acts on that. That's 18. 6, 6, 6. If you do that and you meditate on the object, where is the self experience? Where's the self-referencer? If you meditate on the sense base, you have the same thing. You'll see that it actually is an amazing experience. if you look at the consciousness that's experiencing that, you have no self. What do you have? What do you have when you see and recognize a visual object? Do you have a self, or do you have the recognition of a visual object? Which one? You can do the Vipassana with me. What do you have? Do it right now. Look at a visual object. Is there a self, or is there a visual object? Right. It's easy, isn't it? But a fraction of a second later, you go, yeah, but what does it have to do with me, huh? Or like, I'm bored. Or, gosh, that's lovely. I really like that. God, I feel good. When I look at those teapots up there, man, do I feel good. Especially that flower tea cozy. I just feel good. That's self-referencing. Got it? What happens before that? There isn't even a tea cozy. There's simply an object recognized. Okay. See how fast it is? If you have an itch, is the itch the self?
Is the what?
The itch, the self. Travis, is an itch the self? If you have a bellyache, let's go a little further. If you have a bellyache, is the bellyache yourself? But we often say, my bellyache. I'm having a bellyache. I don't feel well. Correct? But do we say that about an itch? Okay. So he's referencing one of the greatest classic meditations of Vipassana, which is object, sense field, and consciousness. You can't have an object appearing in the mind without the consciousness lighting up the sense base. So you have to have consciousness. So there's three things. Now we get into interdependence and we get into dependent origination. All this is important. There is no object without the consciousness. There's no sense field lit up without consciousness. Consciousness doesn't have an object if there's no object. Consciousness can't function without a sense base. They're all interdependent. What does this mean? There is no object other than the interdependence of object, sense base, and consciousness. Therefore, there is no real object. He's going to get to this. No object exists outside of causes and conditions. There's no entity called an object. Got that? Great. You can go meditate on that. One of the great meditations. Fantastic. 16. Neither atom of form exists, nor is sense organ elsewhere. It's a bit of an awkward... Everybody's translated this in a different way because it's very difficult to translate. Even more, no sense organ as agent exists. So I just described this. So the producer and the produced are utterly unsuited for production. Number 15 precedes number 16 for a reason. I just described it. Here it is. The atoms by themselves can't produce a sense organ. Even if we aggregate the atoms together, it's a highly complex phenomenon. The atoms individually of a sense organ, if we take a sense organ and we burn it, we're going to have carbon, oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, and a little bit of sulfur. Tiny trace amounts of silurium and, well, maybe a bit of iron and so on, okay? Those elements can't make a sense field. They can't, if you just take those elements, if we take all the components of a watch and we spread them on a table, they don't make a watch. Have you ever done that as a kid? I used to do that all the time. I used to take watches apart, but I couldn't put them back together again. I used to drive my parents nuts. Because I thought I could. So I take the watches, and you know, I take my parents' watch apart. And I was sure I could get it back together again. I take all the parts, they've all sitting there, I go, I did that television too once. You know, brand new, and it was RCA television. And I took it apart, all tubes apart. I thought I could get it back together again, working. I couldn't. They didn't really like that very much. So the components aren't the thing. Does that make sense? Components aren't the thing. A brain isn't just a brain. A slab of brain cells isn't a functioning brain. So neither atom of form exists, nor is sense organ elsewhere other than the atoms. The sense field is atoms, but the atoms don't make inherently a sense field. Even more, no sense organ as agent exists. Now, this is what I just described. The sense organ without consciousness doesn't function. The sense organ without an object doesn't function. Many of you experienced that already. You sit here like this long enough, and you'll notice that you don't see the room. It's really simple. Just do this. If you're quite perceptive, you'll see, without trying to imagine a room, you'll see that you're seeing almost nothing. And if you take away the consciousness, which you can do by settling the mind really clearly, you'll see that all you're seeing is maybe points of light or a dark room. It's really, really quite straightforward. So you can actually take the consciousness out of the sense field. So the producer and the produced, that is, like the sense field and the cognition, are utterly unsuited for production. No one thing gives rise to another. No single cause ever gives rise to another thing. Atoms don't solely give rise to sense fields. Human beings aren't just atoms. They're not just molecules. So he's saying, basically, get out of this idea of single causality and that you can explain everything away by knowing about one thing. It's not possible. So I'm currently been asked to work on a project and designing a research project right now with other collaborators at University of British Columbia, is we're trying to figure out why diatoms are on eelgrass. Eelgrass, marine eelgrass, is covered with diatoms, wall-to-wall diatoms, like paint, like stucco. Why are they on there? And the logical reason would be they like the sunlight. So why don't they float in the water? What are they doing on the eelgrass? Why does the eelgrass like them? They'd produce toxins if they didn't like it, to throw them off. And why does it look like they form communities? And what are the communities of bacteria doing on there? And what are the communities of fungi doing on there? So we're now asking the question, what is happening at an ecological level? Whereas before, people would just say, the eelgrass grows, the diatoms grow, it has bacteria. We'd like to know how they're all interrelated. There's no such thing as eelgrass. When you look at eelgrass, it's not eelgrass, it's what you're looking at is diatoms. Underneath are cells of eelgrass. And if you look closer, you see bacteria, masses of bacteria, and you see fungi everywhere. Is there such a thing as eelgrass? No, there's an ecosystem of eelgrass, diatoms, fungi, bacteria, and we're going to probably get into viruses and everything else. And so we have to talk about an ecosystem. Therefore, the producer and the produced are utterly unsuited for production. You can't get your head around this. That means there is no such thing as a soul agent, and there's no such thing as you, and there's no such thing as a self, and there's no such thing as a God-like producer. Okay. And this can come up if you meditate a little further. Number 17. The atoms of form do not produce sense perceptions. Okay, he's repeating himself, and I don't think we need to do that again. For they transcend the realm of the senses. Atoms are far beyond the realms of the senses. If asserted that they are produced through an aggregation of atoms, that the senses are produced through an aggregation of atoms, production through accumulation, too, is unacceptable by logic. So this is a point that Nagarjuna, almost 2,000 years ago, was way ahead of his time. He showed through extraordinary texts and logic that even if you try to explain things through aggregation, just saying a bunch of atoms get together and they do it, not so. Okay, and you can do that too. You can see. Let me give you an example. How many elements do you need to come together to build a house that functions? Do 2x4s make a house? This is what he's getting at. Do 2x4s make a house? No. Does plywood make a house? Does gyprock make a house? Does electrical wiring make a house? Does plumbing make a house? Do you see? If you have electrical wiring in a house, what do you need to do to have electrical wiring function? It has to be hooked up to the mains properly. It has to be hooked up to the hydroelectricity. What else? An incredible infrastructure is sitting behind the lights coming on this house. Right? The infrastructure connected with this, economically, industrially, is it doesn't work.
It's working, it's just very slightly.
Oh, it's so low. Do you have any idea do all of you know what's involved to turn this bulb on? It's not a finger. It's not a house. It's not the electrical mains. It's an entire economic ecosystem. Industrial, modern ecosystem. To make that happen. Boom. Not one thing. It's not my finger doing it. Right? Does it feel like it's my finger? Yeah, it feels like look at this. Watch this. I'm the agent. I'm the creator God. Isn't that amazing? You know, it's like, remember when you were a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old? Remember doing that? I used to do that all the time. Wow. Remember that discovery? maybe that's 2.5. I don't know. Right? Before you have any idea, before you read your book like on, you know, modern industrial complexes and things like that at the age of 4. You know, you pick up your first book and you go, wow, look at that. There's a book on the history of Western economy. And you read that, oh, so it's not this. Okay? That's what he's pointing to. There's no such thing. It's completely ridiculous to say that there is sole agents, not even one or two agents. Collections of things don't make it so. Right? 18. Through division in terms of spatial dimensions. Okay, you might ask a question. I hope you ask this question. What does it have to do with me? Okay, so from a Hinayana point of view, go, hey, but what does it have to do with my problems? Turning on a bulb, turning off a bulb, modern, you know, industrial economy. What does it have to do with me? Everything. Because when you feel you lose sight of interdependent reality. As soon as you lose you, as soon as you get you happening, you completely forget about interdependent arising. It's gone. You've lost emptiness. You've lost the majesty of emptiness. Emptiness is interdependent arising. Why is the light bulb being turned on because the universe is empty. I'll go a little further if I can. Emptiness doesn't mean empty. Emptiness means full. As soon as something is multiply caused, you or it can't truly exist. It can exist as an appearance, as a provisional appearance, but it's actually arising due to manifold interdependence. Get it? And all experience is the same. So it's vital. It's a vital point. So one way we can describe emptiness is not you. The other way we can describe provisionally emptiness is it's utterly transitory and momentary. Therefore, it can't have a real self. Everybody getting this? But the other way, which is really high dharma, is that because everything is interconnected and manifold, you can't have a real entity called self. And that's what he's describing right now. All right? And the Buddha only described that really in the Patana, which is the last book of the Abhidhamma. He didn't really fully describe that well in the Paticcasamuppada, a little bit, pointed to it in the suttas. But really where you find this is in the seventh book of the Abhidhamma exposition. Okay, yes, Chris.
So I'm trying to square this with the Four Noble Truths. So the second noble truth is dependent origination. We're talking about interdependent origination here.
That's a
complex idea.
That's right. So from the Hinayana teaching, everything is linear. So you see, when you see the teaching, everybody knows, maybe some of you don't, the Paticcasamuppada, interdependent origination, it's linear. This causes this.
Right.
That causes that. It's a really high level of teaching, but actually it's not how it works. So as the texts say, it really helps a simple mind, not a stupid mind, a simple mind realize very quickly how causality works, but it's not actually how causality works. So some teachings teach the 12 links as interdependently linked. But if you read how it's taught in the suttas, it's really straightforward for busting up clinging by going linear, one after the other, after the other, after the other. Okay? And it's a very high meditation. But again, it's not full exposition of it. How are you all doing? Have you had enough for this morning? Is that like... Yeah? I can see that. I can see there's brains. I can see steam coming out of you. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop. I'm hoping that at one point, if you keep doing this, you'll just go like this. Whoa. Do you know anything? No. Whatever, it's amazing. People think that the path of the pandita, the path of the scholar yogi, is lower than the yogi. But actually, many beings have become liberated through debate, through practice. Great yogi, I mentioned this a number of times, great yogi, Yeshe, very famous Gelugpa Lama, said that he became liberated. He's also a great recognized tulku, but he became liberated as a teenager during debates on exactly this. It's probably this text, right? Because this is like major mainstream debate form. We were in Tibet. This is the kind of text they're using for debating. And he said it was during that debate that all of a sudden he just landed. Completely got it. But mind you, that being had done a lot of work, and it was a stream of incredibly enlightened activity. But there are many, many beings. Mipham Lama, 19th century, man, he would use debates to liberate beings. He would just walk into a monastery, do exactly this, debates, and they'd have these debates going on for hours, and beings would become liberated. So that was his one of his compassionate activities, going around debating. And people go, "Where'd it go?" Not just through intellect means. You have to also experience here, and here, everywhere. So, very good. So we'll begin again through, we'll start at number 18 tomorrow. Tomorrow? Tomorrow, Saturday. Yeah, why not? Tomorrow's a long prayer. So is this. So we'll also take this up again. We'll see. Some sort of wonk or. Stay tuned. That's very good. So everybody understand all this so far? Great. I won't look around the room too closely.
May I just clarify one point?
Just one tiny remaining point.
Tiny little.
Okay, yeah.
So elements.
Mm-hmm.
Elements refer to the 12 and or the 16?
18.
18 rather?
Yeah, the word dhatu is a loose word that can mean quality, element, base, defined characteristic. So it's a loose word. So the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air are also called dhatus. So like many things in the texts, you can't just translate, you have to know the context. So if you say the 18 elements, you're going, yeah, but there's four. How do we get 18? That's because dhatu is used for the sense bases, and dhatu is used also for the four great elements. So it's just a matter of you have to know the context it's being used. Okay? Many, many terms are used in many ways to bring out the meaning. And this is the danger of just translating from a dictionary. You really have to know the context. And you have to read commentaries to know how Nargajuna or how Nyutan Dorje or how Mipham Lama was using those words in the 19th century. Otherwise, you're just translating from a dictionary. And it's very dangerous. As one of my professors used to say to me, you can't do that. You can do that, but we have to go back to the context of Indian Buddhism at that time to get the flavor of how that verse is constructed. Because it's very dangerous otherwise. Remember, you know, sometimes you do a translation, it's like the cow jumps out of Nagarjuna's heart, and you're going, this isn't quite right. I don't think it's right, but actually, literally, that's what it means. But then you ask, you know, Antrim Rinpoche says, no. Yeah, it's a cow. But actually, it means this. Okay, now it makes sense. This is completely out of context. Just like we have conversations completely out of context. Okay. So let us finish with a short dedication aspiration of the three cycles of Dharma. Okay, let's do a dedication aspiration. Very pithy. Three cycles. Idante punyakamang asawaki wang otu. Idante punyakamang asawaki wang otu. Idante punyakamang asawaki wang otu. By this powerful activity, may it lead to the cessation of the floods, of the cankers, the dukkha, the wandering of all sentient beings. Sabbe sata sutahantu, may all beings have excellent relative happiness and excellent relative health. And may all beings discover primordial awareness, unborn, unceasing, the luminous display of wisdom and compassion as the most glorious gift for all sentient beings. Saramangalam, saramangalam, saramangalam.